Garlic Growers versus United States. Mr. Lanza, please proceed.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, Anthony Lanza, on behalf of plaintiffs and appellants, the New Mexico Garlic Growers Coalition and El Bosque Farm, which is Stanley Crawford. I'm here today with my partner, Brody Smith. We're going to divide duties. He's going to handle the Chevron deference issue for statutory interpretation. That is the question of, do commerce regulations violate the Tariff Act of 1930, thus allowing Harmony to avoid annual review for anti-dumping duties?
Mr. Lanza, let me ask you just sort of preliminarily one question. Page 7 through 8 of your brief, you have the statement of issues. Number one is, did commerce err by rescinding the administrative review with respect to Harmony? And then second issue is, does CFR, the reg, is it invalid? Okay. Those are your first two issues?
Yes, you're right.
Now, let me ask you this. Is the first issue determinative of the case? Assume for the moment we reversed and ruled in your favor and said that the rescission was bad. Okay. Am I correct in thinking we would not then reach the second issue about the validity of the regulation because you then are having your review?
Your Honor, you could reach both issues. They're not mutually exclusive.
But I'm saying if we rule in your favor on the first issue, is it necessary to reach the second issue as a jurisprudential matter?
I think it is. I think it is because you're going to be sending us back in the instance you just described to the Department of Commerce. And they're going to be operating under a regulation that's an invalid interpretation of a statute.
No, but you're going to have your review in place. You're going to, if we send it back, the situation, and correct me if I'm wrong, the situation will be that now Harmony is subject to the review that was rescinded, correct?
This depends, Your Honor.
Is that right?
This depends upon the nature of your remand. If, in fact, you insist that Harmony does get reviewed because Stan Crawford does have standing, as a garlic farmer, which he does, and you insist upon that rather than allowing commerce to reassess the issue, you're right.
If we said it was wrong to rescind the review and we say go back and Harmony has to be reviewed, under that circumstance, I don't see why it'd be necessary to get to issue two.
Yeah,
you'll have gotten the review you want.
Assuming that also that Harmony is treated as a mandatory respondent in that scenario, which is, of course, what we're asking for, because a mandatory once a valid review request is in effect, the foreign exporter should be a mandatory respondent. But yes, in that scenario, I believe you're right.
Now, what if you lose, on the other hand? What if we were to affirm the rescission of the Harmony review?
In the highly unlikely event we lose, Your Honor, yes, you are correct. We would have to look at the invalidity of the regulation under the Chevron deference.
I'm sorry to jump in on you like that, but I kind of wanted to get a sense, in my own mind at least, of how things fall out under different possibilities. Okay.
Perfectly fine. I'm willing to answer any questions, Your Honors. So I'm going to briefly address now standing, which is the issue I'm here for. When you talk about standing, I want to talk about the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is the fact that Harmony submitted the evidence to Commerce proving that Stan Crawford is a New Mexico garlic farmer, although a small one. A garlic farmer.
And can I just...
You bet. Yes, you
So I took it that point is important to your argument because even if one accepts that commerce can say the New Mexico garlic growers lied. We therefore won't believe anything the New Mexico garlic growers say to us. The net result remains a record not dependent on the New Mexico garlic growers' credibility, establishing the only point at issue, namely the New Mexico garlic growers produced a domestic-like product.
Well spoken. Okay. You're right, Your Honor. It is Harmony's submissions that prove that Stan Crawford is a garlic farmer. We believe he's credible, but for purposes of this appeal, it doesn't really matter. And none of the three defendants dispute this, by the way, or even discuss it for that matter.
Well, I understood the counter-argument to be that the initial request was illegitimate because of the misrepresentations. So why wouldn't that govern such that commerce was within its discretion, and we do review this under an abuse of discretion standard, to dismiss, kick out the entire request because of the fraudulent statements?
The alleged misrepresentations did not consist of statements in the initial review request. That's a very small document, which basically just says, please review this foreign exporter. What commerce identified as the alleged lack of credibility, the alleged lies, are matters that happen later during the administrative process, talking about Chinese affiliation, talking about, you know, why did you withdraw a review request a year earlier in AR-20. This, of course, is AR-21. So, no, the alleged lies relate to all those topics subsequent to the review request being filed, and they simply don't matter because Harmony proved.
But why can't commerce say, if it has said, and I'm not sure it has said, if you lie to us, we are entitled, by virtue of background, inherent authority, allowing us to protect the integrity of our proceedings, to dismiss you from the proceedings, not limited to any fact-finding.
Because that's contrary to the statute.
Which statute?
The statute is clear.
Which provision? 1677E?
It's 1673, or, no, 1675, Your Honor, which is the statute governing annual reviews. It says you are entitled to insist upon an annual review if you are a domestic producer. In this case, that amounts to a garlic farmer. That's it. That's the statute. Commerce cannot sidestep that regulation by creating this theory that...
So I gather you're arguing that a claim of inherent authority to dismiss has to be tied to a particular requirement for the standing to request review.
Yes, that's correct.
Why is that so? Why isn't the inherent authority broader?
Because standing matters. Standing is what enables a domestic producer to insist upon a review for a foreign exporter to protect the domestic industry. The purpose of the act.
Yes, but that just goes to standing. You're not answering Judge Toronto's question, which is why doesn't commerce have inherent authority even when standing exists to dismiss a fraudulent petition? Suppose it was fraudulent, not related to standing. Why doesn't commerce have inherent authority to dismiss a fraudulently filed petition, a petition riddled with fraud?
Now, when you talk about a petition, no petition, Your Honor.
I'm not asking you to dispute the facts of my hypothetical. I'm asking you to answer it. Why doesn't commerce have inherent authority if a petition contains fraud in it to dismiss that petition, even if the fraud doesn't go to the standing?
Because there's no authority as such anywhere in the statutes or regulations or even the case law that I'm aware of for a review. We're not talking about a petition. We're talking about an annual review. So I'm going to limit it to an annual review because that's all that's at issue here. And for an annual review, there's no such authority. Now, I notice I'm about out of time. I'd like to reserve.
I just want to be clear.
I can answer that, but I'm going to take.
You've used your time. You've used your rebuttal time.
Yes.
You guys are the same party. I'm not giving him full time when you use his time. I would suggest that you keep going because I'll tell you right now,
okay,
his points are not nearly as important as yours.
Okay,
but
Your
that's
Honor.
Up to the two of you to work out, but I'm not going to be micromanage you both.
Okay. Well, understood. Now,
Mr. Lanza, let me, in this regard, because this goes to the point I was saying, the regulation has two requirements as I read it. First of all, you have to be an interested party, correct?
Correct.
Second, you have to explain why the person desires the secretary to review those particular exporters or producers. Okay? Now, why are the three alleged misrepresentations here not pertinent to that why question?
First of all, there's no requirement of a certain motive. The regulation does ask to explain why, which, by the way, is not derived from the statute. It's only in the regulation. But it doesn't say what the why must be. There's no requirement anywhere
You have to say why you're seeking the review, right?
Correct. Under the regulation, not the statute, you're correct.
Okay. And I would think it's not unreasonable for Congress to require someone to present honest answers as to why they're seeking a review, correct?
Yes, but it could be because I like blue shoes.
Well,
if
someone says, I'm seeking this request for reasons A, B, and C, so I comply with the regulation, and it's determined that A, B, and C are false, why, under the cases, does Commerce not have the discretion to disregard that and say you haven't done what you have to do to obtain a review, so we rescind it?
Because there's no requirement anywhere for a particular motive for a domestic reviewer, for a domestic party to insist upon a review request.
You're right. So maybe if they had told the truth and said, and I know you're saying allegedly, so just skip over that for a second. Maybe if they had told the truth and said, why I'm desiring it is because somebody else, a different exporter, foreign exporter, paid me $50,000 to do this, maybe we would then be confronted with the question of whether or not Congress is allowed to import some sort of motivation into the request. But that's not the set of facts we have here. We have a set of facts about them making an assertion as to why and Commerce determining that that assertion was a lie. And so that's where we are now. So given that they lied in their request, why doesn't Commerce have inherent authority to rescind the request at that point?
Because Commerce didn't identify any lies in the request. Commerce was explicit in the final IDM that motive doesn't matter. What Commerce identified were alleged lies that are irrelevant. Things like...
So you're making, I think, two different points, so let me try to separate them. One is a timing point. The issues and decision memo identifies essentially three assertions that it says were knowingly false.
Correct.
Does it say those assertions were made in the request or at some later point?
At some later point.
Okay, so even if they are legally immaterial, you have a point about timing.
Yes.
And do you think that makes the regulatory requirement inapplicable to these, by assumption, lies?
Yes, because the review request is a very narrow document. It's literally two pages. It just basically says, I'm a domestic producer. I'd like you to take a look at the foreign exporter and do what the Act requires, which is see if they're dumping and impose duties if they are.
Where is that document in the JA?
Where is the review request?
I am not able. I can sit down and find that exact APPX. I'm not able to identify that at this point.
Did that document state why the person desires?
Yes, it did. It's a very brief statement.
Do you remember, if you can't point us to it,
I'm going to
what it said?
But it's a very brief statement, and it essentially says to ensure that the domestic garlic farming industry can compete fairly with exporters who are exporting garlic into the U.S. Notably, Harmony, which is the largest exporter of Chinese garlic into the U.S. That's essentially what it says. That's not a verbatim quote. It's very brief, and it's completely true. And it wasn't challenged. This is the important point. Commerce didn't challenge that comment. Commerce challenged the alleged credibility of later comments.
Might that be false because it was a contrived reason, not the real reason?
It's irrefutable that Stan Crawford is a domestic producer of garlic. He is a garlic farmer. He sells garlic. Garlic competes with garlic. It's inevitable that his garlic at some level competes with the garlic being imported by Harmony and others. And this is part of the record. He's expressly said, my prices compete with their prices because for many people, garlic is garlic. Although there is, of course, a distinction between fresh garlic and imported garlic, certainly if you talk to Stan Crawford and others as well. But ultimately, it's garlic. So they're competing. So that statement is inevitably true. And the record confirms it as well. And further, it's not what Commerce challenged as being allegedly lies. Those were other things that were irrelevant to the review request and irrelevant to standing.
Well, what they challenged was the why, right? What was put into question was the why was this request filed?
No, let me quote from the final IDM, the final decision. A legitimate domestic producer might have ties or affiliations with foreign companies, and this would not cause the domestic producer to lose its status as a domestic interested party under the Act. So it's not about that. This foreign affiliation issue, even Commerce said it doesn't matter. And Commerce.
So is your point, just so I understand it, that what Commerce did is not necessarily what the CIT said and what is being argued to us now? Because I think that what went up on appeal and what the CIT said seems quite a bit more extensive than what you just read to me.
That's not my recollection, Your Honor. It is a long decision from Judge Barnett at the CIT. But I don't believe he focused on the alleged lies that Commerce focused on, which were those three categories I mentioned, none of them being in the review request, all of them coming subsequent to the review request in the process administered by the Department of Commerce.
Can't they impact the review request?
Can those alleged lies impact the review request?
He was paid to file this and had no personal motive to desire to do so. If that was what the record showed, couldn't that impact the review request? Just because the lie was uncovered later doesn't mean it can't affect his earlier actions.
The alleged lies would not impact because he's a domestic producer. This is what gets lost in this conversation. The statute requires one thing and one thing only. You need to be a domestic producer. That's the point of the act.
You're correct. He has to be a domestic producer. I agree. But being the domestic producer, he also has to explain why he is seeking the review. That's part of the regulation. And if that is misrepresented, the why is misrepresented, why is it wrong for Commerce to exercise the inherent authority it has that's been identified in TSK and another case to rescind?
Because the why only appears in the regulation, not in the statute.
But you haven't challenged that part of the regulation, have you?
Yes. Yes, we're challenging the regulation, that part of the regulation.
But I don't recall.
But here's what's important.
But I don't recall a challenge to the requirement in the regulation that the person requesting the review explain why the review is being requested. I don't recall a challenge to that.
You may be right about that, Your Honor. That portion of our brief is being handled by my partners. You may be right about that narrow issue, but more importantly.
No, it's not a narrow issue. I mean, it's part one of the why seems to be fairly important here.
But the why never, there's no statement anywhere as to what the why must be. There's no requirement anywhere as to what the motive must be. So the why can be.
Only that it must be sincere.
Well, I'm not aware of that requirement, but that would be a fair requirement. That would be a fair requirement. I'm not aware of where it states that. The congressional statute is crystal clear. You just have to be a domestic producer. Because that's the point of the act, to protect the domestic
I think we
industry.
Have your argument. With my colleague's indulgence, we'll give Mr. Smith 2 minutes to make. And if my colleagues have a lot of questions, of course, that might go longer. But and we'll restore a minute or two of rebuttal time for you. We'll sort of play it out.
I would appreciate a little bit of rebuttal time because I can further expand on this.
Well,
I'm sure you would appreciate
rebuttal time, but you've used all of your time, all of your rebuttal time, and almost all of his time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So, you know, sit down.
I just want to let you know that I can talk about 3 cases on this precise issue.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The 1984 amendment to the annual review statute, section 1675, 19 U.S.C. 1675, simply added the phrase, if a request for such a review has been received. And over time, the Commerce Department came to interpret that phrase as not only establishing a triggering event, the filing of a review request, but also as essentially modifying the scope, allowing some companies to be excluded from the review if they weren't named in a review request. But the rest of that statute, the rest of the Act, and the legislative history are inconsistent with that interpretation. to the point where it shouldn't survive a Chevron analysis. The amendment was never intended to change, essentially, the scope. The very same statute, 1675, subsection A2, continues to require in every review a redetermination of the dumping margin for, quote, each entry of subject merchandise. Now, the trade court ruled that that phrase is modified and narrowed by the if requested language five paragraphs above it, which the trade court ruled can, under Chevron, be interpreted as allowing company-specific reviews. There's two points in response. Both entry and subject merchandise are defined terms in the Act and are used throughout the Act to refer to specific products coming from a specific country. These are not company-specific concepts under the Act. Also, the legislative history of this 1984 amendment shows that the addition of that phrase, if a request for such a review has been received, was not intended to change the scope. House Report 98-725 at page 22 explains how that 1984 amendment was supposed to eliminate reviews of an entire order if there was no interest from the domestic industry, not to allow companies to be excluded if they weren't named.
Mr. Lanza, I think, said that you could illuminate one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct in thinking that the Garlic Growers Association or Council does not challenge the provision in the regulation that requires a person requesting a review to state why the review is being requested?
Are you asking if we do not challenge that?
I understand. It's been my understanding mm-hmm. that provision was not being challenged. I realize you're making another argument. Mm-hmm. You've just been articulating it. But I don't see anywhere a challenge to the requirement in the regulation that the person requesting a review explain why he or she is requesting the review.
To be frank, I don't believe that is in our briefing, but I could be wrong.
I can accept you're not challenging the validity of that requirement.
I am not, no.
Okay.
Okay, well, your time is up. You've exceeded it by a minute. So let's move on and hear from the other side. Okay, so before we even start with the other side, I hope that the two of you appreciate that that was a mistake, a tactical mistake on your part. You don't divide up time like that. We could have, he was adamant. He's got three more cases. That was the point we wanted. At that point, you should have ceded your time because he said he thought he had something really important that was clearly directly on point with what we wanted to talk about. Over here, I can't fathom for the life of me how three of you are arguing, two are going to argue for 1 minute each. I expect you to stand up, tell me the name of the firm you're with, who else is at counsel table with you, and all the formalities. I will use your 1 minute that way, and then you will sit down afterwards. That is tactically crazy. It's not helpful to the court to do that. Go ahead.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. I will address the question head on. Regarding the petitioner's argument.
No, you didn't listen. You start with who you are, what firm you're with, and who else is at counsel table with
you. I apologize, Your Honor. I'm with the defendant of the United States. My name is Ming Yuo. I'm a trial attorney with the Department of Justice. I'll start, I guess, with what the central issue was that petitioners were addressing regarding their point of view that domestic production should decide the issue on standing. And I do want to point to 19 CFR 351.213, which we think defeats that point because it specifically requires domestic producers to indicate why they want the review request.
Do you have the JA site for the request that's at issue?
I do. It's Appendix 143, I believe, and we cite it on page 10 in our brief.
Right, and I've been looking at that. I don't see any reference to why at all. I mean, it seems to me, tell me if there's something asserted there about why.
Well, it starts on 143.
Yeah, it's about six sentences, so it's not very
and
long.
Then it actually continues because it was actually part of a package. So if you go to, they attach a brief. It wasn't part of the initiating petition. It came a few days later because there they do express why, and that was starting on page 171 of the
appendix. 171?
171, correct, Judge Toronto.
And is this brief considered part of the request?
I believe it's like supplementary information in support of the initiating petition because it just came, I think, 5 days after the initiating petition. So they attach this 10-page brief. We highlight 2 points on appendix page 172. The top of the page, the first full paragraph, NMGGC wants to take this opportunity to express why investigating Harmony is important to the ability of NMGGC and to similar garlic producers throughout New Mexico to compete in the fresh garlic market. So there they go on to extensively explain why, at least on the face of it, they are requesting the review. I do want to point out one thing which we don't mention in our brief because it did come up during the petitioner's argument. If you look at APPX page 179, which is the last page of their brief in support of their initiating petition, they go through great lengths to talk about Harmony and its affiliations with FGPA and about how that suspicious relationship should raise commerce's concern. And what they do when addressing their own interest is, this is the last sentence right before the conclusion.
What page were you on?
APPX 179. In this respect, the regulations make clear the department may disregard views of domestic producers who are also importers of the subject merchandise and domestic producers who are related to such importers. I think right there, that kind of encapsulates this idea that if there's some type of, you know, questionable relationship.
And it's citing Section 732 C4B II. What is that in 19 USC terms?
I'm not precisely sure. I'm sorry.
Well, because it matters whether we're talking about the petition or administrative review. Undoubtedly, at the petition stage, there's a massive inquiry, largely, or, you know, ultimately decided by the International Trade Commission about the domestic industry.
Correct.
There's no such inquiry at the administrative review. If this is about the initial, you know, anti-dumping duty petition stage, it would be significantly more limited.
So in the petition stage, Judge Toronto, you are correct that the ITC, the International Trade Commission, does regularly go behind the face of the petition to look at the credibility of the domestic interested party's interest in the review petition itself. But we think that the law makes clear that that same interest is important during the credibility determinations for the administrative review process as well. And we think it would be a bit unusual if you can only ask that question in the first instance regarding the initiation of the anti-dumping duty order, but then you can no longer make that inquiry for administrative reviews of that order. We think that would be a disconnect. And two authorities that I think would be helpful to the court in this regard, and that's kind of been the law before the trade court in Shandong Rongshin and the brothers case that we cite in our brief. I think it's page 43 of our brief, where they do talk about the legislative history behind the domestic interested party statute with respect to this case.
And the 732 is, in fact, 1673A. So
it is
actually okay. Not about the administration.
It's about the petition. Correct, Judge. But the case law makes clear, and the legislative history makes clear, that the why actually is important, because the reason why the domestic interested party provision was phrased as the way it was because they wanted to ensure that parties that had no stake in the result of the investigation wouldn't be filing petitions that would eviscerate commerce's resources when it could be better spent on other issues that they had to address.
Why isn't I produce garlic here, isn't enough to give them a stake under the statute?
Well, in addition to that, under the regulation, they would have to state the why, right? So 19 CFR 351.213B says, so you are a domestic producer, and then it says in the conjunctive, what is your interest? So you actually have to say, I am a domestic producer, and here's my interest.
Do you also have the view that the validity of that piece of the regulation has not been challenged here?
It has not been challenged, Judge, and I think the briefing will show that. Okay. And that's actually what we rely on, because at the end of the day...
The Issues and Decisions memo says, here are the three things that we think were lied about. Do some of those appear in this document, or are they other things? The falsehoods.
I'm sorry.
Isn't there a 1, 2, 3 in the Issues and Decisions memo that says here are the three assertions which we're gathering from? And there's a whole lot of little footnotes citing to letters and things. There are three assertions that Commerce said you lied about these things when you made these assertions. Are any of those assertions in this document 171 to 179? Doesn't that kind of matter under the regulation?
I think it I think it would, but I think it's actually a progressive issue throughout the entirety of the review, right? It was baked into the entire review. If we're talking about what they're stating their interest is.
Right, but here's what I guess I'm trying to focus on and why I came to this. Your brief makes a very broad brush argument. We have inherent authority to respond to lies to us. Even if, under this broad brush theory, the lies are immaterial, and even if when we respond under 1677E by getting rid of every credibility-based piece of evidence from the liar, the fact, the only facts relevant, remain established. And it seems to me the one possibility of your having a narrower position than that is the regulation, the one that we have discussed. And right. So it might matter whether the lies were in the document covered by the regulation as opposed to other things.
Right. And I think one case that might be helpful would be the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals that we cite in our brief, where the D.C. Circuit actually evaluated the question of standing under the Endangered Species Act. Now, I recognize it's a different statute, but again, it's a statutory-based standing, and we're also dealing with statutory-based standing in that case. In that case, the parties proceeded all the way to trial, where it was the trial judge that held, after observing the witness on the stand, that his interest in the review under the Endangered Species Act, because he was a paid plaintiff, because he insistently lied, because his motivations were questionable, the court at trial said, you no longer have standing. So the standing inquiry isn't necessarily limited just to the initiating petition.
Right, but what I'm having trouble with, it seems to me, let's assume for purposes of this question that there is evidence from Harmony establishing beyond any doubt that the New Mexico growers produced a like-kind product. Mm-hmm. Standing done over indisputable. Assume that that's right. Nevertheless, we've been discussing quite a lot this morning about this piece of the regulation that says you have to tell us why, mm-hmm. which it seems to me cannot meaningfully go to standing in the statutory sense, interested party. But nevertheless, an unchallenged regulation is a communication that the agency is interested in this subject. And that regulation says, tell us why in this document. Was there a lie in this document?
And to be fair, I don't think the agency treated the regulation as limiting them only to one document. I think if they're going to say, what is your interest in the review? And at the heart of it, that interest could evolve or change throughout the course of the review. And at those various points, if the stated interest during the course of the review is undermined by the record evidence, Commerce should have the ability, broad-based authority, to say, you've repeatedly lied to us, you've undermined the integrity of the proceedings. And to get to that conclusion, they relied on that TKS line of authority that says...
Right, but TKS and Alberta were very specifically about the foreign producer or exporter whose assertions about either affiliation with the government-wide entity or what they did were absolutely the central issue in the administrative review. Or actually, yes, in TKS, Alberta Gas was not an administrative review. It was the initial proceeding
right.
where the domestic parties' effect on domestic industry
right.
was crucial. We don't have either of those two things.
Right.
We have the filer of a request under 1675
right.
who apparently, beyond dispute, meets the statutory standard of producing domestic-like product.
Right, and I believe that Commerce did not question that part of it. What they did was they said under the regulation, it's two-pronged. It's domestic production and credible interest in interest in the review pursuant to the regulation. And when they found that...
I'm sorry, the regulation doesn't say some interest more than domestic-like product. It just says, tell us honestly why... you desire the review. And it seems to me it's perfectly possible to lie about your statement, why, without that statement being a false statement if it was yours. In other words, I'm going to keep using this word, it was a contrived assertion, even if it was a true assertion about the underlying interest that there could have been, but it wasn't your real interest. You had a different interest.
Right. But the way the regulation is stated is actually in the conjunctive. It's and. So it can't just be redundant of the previous statement where that you must be a domestic producer, which also means you have an interest in the review. It says you must be a domestic producer and you must also state what you're interested in the review. So we think that the regulation is best read as two separate requirements, which is why I think NMGGC understood that and also supplemented.
Okay, well, let me, with all of that kind of legal superstructure around it, you may have answered this, in which case, just say it again so that I remember. Is there a lie in the document 171 to 179?
We think that this stated interest regarding the review of Harmony on behalf of a purported domestic interested party in totality is false, because what the record evidence shows is that NMGGC was consisting of paid plaintiffs who were discovered by an attorney representing Chinese garlic clients looking for domestic parties to essentially stand in the shoes of a domestic producer to essentially request a petition that they couldn't have otherwise requested, because foreign exporters aren't allowed to petition Commerce to begin a review of a foreign exporting rival. That's
but precisely. Crawford and Katz could have.
If they were independent,
even
yes, they could
joined
have.
Up and they're the... called themselves the New Mexico Garlic.
And to be fair, Judge Toronto, I think if those were the facts of the case, Commerce probably wouldn't have dug that deep, because the record evidence wouldn't have shown this treasure trove of documents showing an intent to manipulate Commerce's review process. At the end of the day, that's what this case is about. Commerce needed to affect the statute and use this case's authority regarding TKS and home products to defend the integrity of its review process. If reviews are like this is allowed, we're basically inviting other parties to undermine Commerce's review authority, and we think that Congress never intended that outcome. I see that my time is up. We respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court in this case.
Thank you. But no, they got a lot more people coming, I think. Mr. Herman?
Good morning. May it please the court, John Herman with Kelly Dry and Warren on behalf of the Appalese Fresh Garlic Producers Association. Since my time is short, I'd like to refer the court to one portion of the regulation, 351.213b2. That is the portion of the regulation that states that a foreign producer or exporter may only request a review of itself. What's going on here is that you have, as counsel for the United States just indicated, you have a purported domestic producer standing in the shoes and putting forward a review request on behalf of a Chinese entity that it otherwise would not have been able to make. With respect to your question, Judge Toronto, regarding whether there were any misrepresentations in the request for an administrative review, I would say yes, absolutely. You mentioned the three findings that the Commerce Department made in its issues and decision memo, the first of which was whether Chinese exporters and businessmen were involved in the NMGGC review request. That clearly was the reason that the request went forward. If you look at the administrative record,
your time is up.
Thank you very much.
I let you go over, Mr. Marshak.
Ned Marshak on behalf of Harmony, Your Honor. There were lies in the request and the second letter on Appendix 174, 175. There was a claim, quote, during the 20th AR, Mr. Crawford was scared off and withdrew his request at the Department Review Harmony if the private investigators were sent to inspect his facility and prior to his business. That's one of the three lies. That's in Appendix 174, 175. Second, in the original request, Mr. Montoya, on behalf of the NMGGC, said the undersigned is handling this case independent from any member of this firm for the purpose of avoiding the appearance of a conflict of interest. That was a second law, Your Honor. He was handling it under the direction of Mr. Hume, who was counsel for the QTF entity, and the CIT actually looked at that. That one wasn't one of the three, but it was very, very critical. This case was handled on behalf of the QTF entity. It was not independent. It was always on the behalf of the QTF entity, the Chinese exporter, and they were the real parties of interest. So in the original document, you have two flat-out lies. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Marshak. Okay, Mr. Alonso, we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did find the answer to the one question, notably from Justice Toronto. In the CIT opinion, APPX 33, Judge Barnett states the why that was listed by Mr. Crawford as follows. Why investigating Harmony was important to the ability of the coalition and to similar garlic producers throughout New Mexico to compete in the fresh garlic market. So this is from Judge Barnett, APPX 33, to compete in the fresh garlic market, which of course makes sense for a garlic farmer, which of course Mr. Crawford is. Now, the Shangdong case
but
is mentioned by...
Just to be clear, the letter from 171 to 179 introduces its reason for being as stating the reasons why we're participating, which suggests that every word that follows is also about that subject, including the words about being scared off Administrative Review 20.
The actual review
is one of the express issues and decisions specified lies.
Your Honor, the actual review is 143 and 144. APPX 143, 144.
That doesn't contain a statement of why at all. Not a word, does it?
I'm not sure about. I thought that was what Judge Barnett was quoting here from the opinion. But perhaps he's actually referring to... The 171 is a supplemental filing that comes after the initial review request. And I don't know whether 143 and 144 actually
states. It's the supplemental comments. It's the 171, 179 that Judge Barnett was quoting.
Okay. And that's where he's listing the why being to compete in the fresh garlic market. And that's what he's identifying in his final decision. That's what he's looking at is the why, which we believe is not only true, but actually doesn't matter. Because again, there's no requirement anywhere that there be a motive. Now... And I can actually speak about that, but there's not really enough time. I'm going to move to the Shangdong case, which the U.S. brought up. The Shangdong case does not require a stake for a domestic producer. It talks about a stake in the limited context of an initial petition for a review request. An initial petition to establish an anti-dumping duty order, which is under a separate section than the annual review requests that come along later after the order is in place. So that's why Shangdong does not support any need
thank
for a
you,
state.
Mr. Lanza. You've exceeded your time again.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank the lawyers. The case is taken under submission.